You're listening to the Busy Creator Podcast, episode 90, with guest Kat Rose. Hello and welcome to the Busy Creator Podcast from BusyCreator.com. This is the show that explores the tools, techniques, and habits you can use to become your most creative, productive self. From New York City, I'm your host, Prescott Perez Fox. This is episode 90 of the Busy Creator Podcast, and today I'm speaking with Kat Rose, who is herself a designer and also the founder of The Creative Introvert, a website and community focused on creative professionals who share certain introverted traits. An interesting point of view, certainly, because so much of internet chatter comes at us hard and fast from very extroverted marketer types. So, listen up and see where you can identify yourself and see where you can make adjustments in your workflow or in your communication style to make the best use of your own personality. Show notes for this episode are available online at busycreator.com/90 for episode 90. And that's where we'll have all the links, book recommendations, quotations, and contact details. Now, before we begin, I want to give a quick shout out to Brandon TBM, who left a review for this show on iTunes. Now, this is something I hardly mention, but I absolutely appreciate the time to give the show a star rating or a quick review, because that helps others discover the show, and that in turn helps build community. So, Brandon, thank you. And to everyone else, head to busycreator.com/iTunes to show some love. Now, let's show some love for introverts and designers and get right into the conversation with Kat Rose. I spoke to her via Skype from her home office in Brighton on the south coast of England. Hey, Kat, how are you?
Hi, Prescott. I'm good.
Yeah, thanks for joining me. I'm really glad to talk to you and for coordinating this call. And you're phoning in from Brighton, the British Riviera. And a fun fact, I've actually been to Brighton.
No way.
Yeah, as well as the village of Rottingdean in Sussex and to the University of Sussex as well.
Yes, I sometimes take little walks down to Rottingdean, and it's lots of very cute tea rooms, and it's all very English.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I studied in Farnham as a graduate student.
Oh.
And so same thing. It's like the type of town that's on the tin of biscuits,
yes.
You know, quintessentially English, right down to the Victorian post boxes, which are kind of nestled in these like stone walls.
That's exactly so,
fun little place. Yeah, exactly. But anyway, now we're talking over the internet, and I'm in, you know, Brooklyn, which is a little less picturesque at the moment, but I'm glad to speak with you, and I hope we can dive into your practice and your work as well as your subject matter expertise. So it's kind of a hybrid episode where we're talking about you, but also talking about a topic. But yeah, let's start right from the top. So we were talking on email about your work as a designer. So I'm curious to hear about that side of things. So do you still call yourself a designer? I mean, how do you describe yourself and your work lately?
Yeah, I definitely am a jack of all trades.
Right.
So I'm trying to focus and do that. You know, that seems to be the in thing to do. But naturally, I think having multiple income streams is the way that I'm currently working.
Mm-hmm.
Designing websites, branding, these are things that people always seem to need. And that is my experience. I went to university, studied graphic design, and straight after that, realized that people needed websites. They didn't need nice posters and brochures. That seems to be less in demand. But at the time, website designers were the way to go. So spent about 3 years at a small agency in London doing that before I realized that I just wasn't cut out for an office job.
Right.
Literally just being in the environment. And this is something we can dive into a bit.
Yeah.
But just as an introvert, you know, like I'll start the day and I'll be totally fine. But a few hours in, my energy kind of drops.
Yeah.
Whereas if I'm working from home, that doesn't happen. And I can kind of go with my energy and just keep going, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I want to put that on the shelf just for a little bit,
the
introvert topic. But I mean, you mentioned, of course, that you're working from home. So are you a solo practitioner? You have your own operation?
Yeah, completely. So when I went freelance, I decided that I'll just give it a go for 6 months and, you know, see if I can get any work. And in that time, I certainly built up some great clients, and that's just kind of kept ticking by. I also tried to pursue my illustration dream, I would say, and that kept me going after a very, very slow start. So that I learned a lot about having to be a one-man show, one-woman show, and
yeah.
Do the self-promotion and all of that. against, you know, I don't know anyone who like loves self-promo.
Right.
But it slowly became something that I just realized had to be done. And that was all part of the package. You couldn't just sit at home and make lovely art and expect people to find you.
Yeah.
At least that's what.
Oh, yeah.
How it worked for me.
Absolutely. And if you've listened to this show, you know about my struggles in that regard that I've sort of mentioned. I don't know if I should, but I kind of mentioned that there are, I guess, two types of solo practitioners or freelancers, whatever you want to call them, the ones who always have clients and the ones who don't. And you never really hear from folks who sort of have these periods of where they're like out of work. And is it just a matter of like hitting your Behance page more and more, or is it going to events? And no one really wants to talk about that. So I'm definitely trying to examine that in a future episode, like how to crack the formula if there is one, and whether it depends on this weird soup of personality plus work history plus momentum plus confidence plus, you know, it's this weird amalgam. Absolutely.
And it's definitely like the unglamorous side of things. You know, it's the idea that we're artists, we're better than that, we don't need to sell our souls by you know, reaching out to people and kind of bombarding the internet with our work. And we're also told that we do need to do all of this stuff, and that can be very overwhelming. Mm-hmm. And it's not always the case that just, like you said, putting more stuff up on Behance or tweeting more is going to bring in clients. No.
Yeah.
But like you said, it's this soup, and trying to get that just right is a bit of an art in itself.
definitely. Yeah. It's funny, you call yourself an artist, and I sometimes say, like, I definitely don't call myself an artist. I'm more of a mechanic, right? Where it's the kind of working class ethic of a plumber, where you walk through the front door, you're like, show me where the problem is. Thank you for your opinion. I'll fix this. You know what I mean?
And yes.
Especially if you work in branding sometimes, like you see what a company has set up for themselves, or in websites too. Are you kidding? And where they'll have some spaghetti code from 1999, and you're just like, oh boy, I'm going to just sort this out. Like, sit back, relax, and I got this. So that's not very artistic-like. But that is perhaps the interesting part of the design profession and other creative fields, you know, that you're, on the one hand, you're doing something artistic, you're using applied arts, but at the same time, you're fixing a business problem, you're creating a workflow or a practice that is a little more practical.
Yes, actually, that's always what appealed to me about design. I studied fine art at school, but it always felt pointless and self-indulgent. And I've got a big problem with that. Even illustration, to an extent, can feel a bit self-indulgent to me. I have to have a brief. I have to have a purpose. Mm. And not to say that fine artists don't have those things, but it's just the way I have to see it in my mind. I have to see an endpoint that I like check that box.
Yeah.
I've done the job.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah, like a mechanic. Yeah.
So what are the scale of some of your projects? And do you team up with other people and you bring the illustration and they bring the layout and someone else brings the websites? And tell us a bit about the actual projects you work on.
Yeah, that's so varied. Illustration has been very much off my own back. I would set myself a brief, and I basically turned my art effectively into more of a product line. And from that, I realized, do people really just want drawings of random cartoon animals? No, but they do want it to mean something to them. And that's how I kind of got into pet portraits.
All right.
So that's how that works. And obviously, pretty straightforward. Somebody sends me a photo of their cat, dog. They even had bears adopted, not like in their living room. And that's what I would do. So that would be my brief. It's just like me working with one person. And that's definitely how I think I work best. Whereas design projects, it can be anything from me going into an agency who already have their own setup, and I come in as just a standard freelancer and, you know, love them and leave them kind of thing. But I've also got return clients. That agency job that I had for 3 years, they still require a freelancer from time to time. So we've still got this like 7-8 year relationship, and that's really, really lovely to have that and see that company grow.
Yeah.
I really love that change. I think that having a mixture of things on the ball is just what appeals to me. It's what keeps me going.
Sure, absolutely. I think a lot of folks listening can empathize or can kind of have been in that exact situation. And I have too. And as we record this, I'm getting ready to go on site with a client for the next 3 weeks or so, which is a bit of a change of pace because I've been working for myself by myself from home for the past couple of months in the summer, and actually all of 2016 so far. So it's a little bit of a change of pace. I'm not opposed to it, but it is interesting how some people do go back and forth. Mm. And on one day you're a one person agency and you're doing everything, you're doing the paperwork, you're doing the taxes, and then the next day you're a freelancer and you're just kind of a mercenary, as you say, where you're just like, yeah. I'm again, the plumber, right? Like, show me where the problem is. I'm not going to get emotionally attached.
Yeah. And what do you think? Like, do you like having that, being able to switch off? I feel like that's something that I can do a bit more when I'm in the environment of an agency. Because I feel like, yeah, there are other people. There's often a project manager who's taking care of me and liaising with the client. Whereas if it is just me running the show, can be a bit stressful.
Yeah.
I don't know if you can relate to that at all.
Yeah. And I actually spoke to Matt Ingelot about this on his podcast, about being an on-site freelancer, doing short-term projects, working with placement agencies. And that's kind of, again, like never talked about. You never hear folks at a conference say like, oh yeah, I used to do 5-day projects and that was how I earned my living for 6 years or whatever it was. But I have been doing that for a long time. After a while, you kind of outgrow it where you're like, another day, it always feels like your first day. You sit down at a desk, you're like, this isn't my desk. And then they show you where the project files are and you're like, this is disorganized. So after a while, you stop saying, oh, that's interesting. And you start saying, that's not how I would do it.
Yeah.
And maybe that's a sign of growing up, right? And I've been fortunate in the last, I guess, 18 months or so that when I have worked on site, it has been more of a consultant. And so the durations have been longer. And also my role has been more project level rather than sort of artifact level, if that makes sense. But yeah, I think in the future, I would not mind doing that consulting thing, but it would definitely have to be more of the multi-month project. And actually, I've been telling folks, you know, we're like, listen, if you need me to come to your city, like to get on a plane to Seattle for 4 weeks and like rent an accommodation, like we're, you know, work on a project on that, like I'm down with that. That's something I've never really done before. But the only difference is there's got to be a level of expertise. So it's not just effort. It's not just a guy, right? You often hear that. You're like, I need a guy in the office for the next 3 weeks. It would have to be like me specifically. But yeah, so going back and forth, doing that sort of thing, you see a lot of different work environments as well. And so sometimes you see the where you can do your best work and try to replicate it at home. And sometimes you see when it's a complete disaster. And then you say, okay, I know to avoid that, the structures and the workflows and everything like that.
Yeah, there's something to be learned from every project. Even if you could say, oh, I'm not super proud with the outcome or I wouldn't have done it that way, there is always something to be learned.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, well, tell us about your studio setup at home, because I'm always curious to hear about this, about your desk and your workstation, the type of software that you rely on. I mean, take us home and kind of paint that picture.
Sure. I live in a very small studio apartment. It's by the sea, so that to me is the most important thing. It's not about space having the most elaborate studio setup. It definitely isn't. It's a desk. I'm looking at it now. It's got a lovely plant on it. but I just run everything off a laptop, a MacBook Pro, super old. And I was saying this to somebody the other day. For some reason, I've stopped using a mouse and a separate keyboard and a separate monitor. I've just really gone minimal with my last move, and I've really enjoyed it. I don't know why. I just feel like having the less stuff I have, the happier I am. And I feel like my workflow hasn't changed. If anything, it's my mind has cleared. When it comes to software, it's for sure the Adobe Suite. I feel like I'm a stickler for using all of the applications for what they are meant to be used for. Like I was talking to somebody the other day who does all of his designing, illustration, everything in Flash, which I thought was an interesting choice.
Wait, what year was this conversation happening?
Yeah, exactly. And so, yeah, that was a recent eye-opening idea. I mean, maybe it would be interesting to try and do a project in a completely different application that you're not used to using, or that is even meant for that particular type of project. But for me, I can't imagine spending my life in Flash.
Yeah. Yeah, that reminds me. I read an article recently on Medium where someone was instructing basically how to use Sketch for print design. And he was talking about resolution and about color space and about setting up a grid and everything. And, you know, there's a lengthy article. And at the end, someone just commented like, you monster, you know, because the whole thing is just like, you would never use Sketch for print design. The whole reason Sketch exists is because the current print design applications, especially InDesign and Illustrator, are not intended for screen resolutions and for pixel measurements and that sort of thing. So a very odd turn like that. But how about for the project management side of things? Do you use Kanban boards and workflowy and any of those type of things?
I just keep it super simple, but Trello is my life and soul. Mm. And I tell everyone I meet, like, it's all about Trello. Like, that's all I need. I'm so grateful for those guys. So it's pretty much Trello, Evernote helps me with just being my brain. And that really is it. When people, sometimes clients will get me to hop on, God, the name has lost me. Not Asana, the other one.
Basecamp?
No.
Another project?
Starts with an S.
Oh, I don't know.
But yeah, it's like Asana, and you're talking within the application.
Oh, Slack, probably.
Slack, that's the one.
Yep.
Yeah, so we use Slack quite a bit. And again, that's another interesting part of coming in as a freelancer. You have to dive into these different tools that you're not used to working in. And I actually think I adapt pretty quickly to that.
Yeah.
Like, somebody was asking me the other day, do I use After Effects? And I was like, in one sentence, no, but I will. Like, right. No, but I will learn. Like, for sure, I know that I'm adaptable. You have to be.
Yeah, absolutely. And especially the good news about using the Adobe Cloud is that there's a certain similar language to them. So, for example, I use Audition for the podcast and for editing audio. And moving to Premiere to edit video, you see a lot of the similarities. It's kind of meant to be that you can learn one and then the other.
Yes.
Don't have any experience in After Effects. But yeah, I'm the same type of thing where I'll just jump right in. Cool. So I want to take a quick break. And then when we come back, I want to hear all about this creative introvert.
Awesome.
Okay, just a quick break to let you know about the sponsor for this episode, the book Building Brands. This is the new ebook I wrote specifically for you, creative professionals, as a step-by-step guide to collaborate with clients to craft and maintain an enduring, appropriate, versatile brand strategy and identity design. It's an interactive PDF, over 70 pages, and includes detailed protocols you and your team can follow to set up your brand identity projects for success from the start. The book covers how to structure a project, the personnel involved at each phase, and time estimates you can use throughout. There's also appendices with blank templates, recommendations on books and other resources, and a few quick and dirty diagrams as well. Check out the book over at busycreator.com/buildingbrands for more info and to purchase. That's busycreator.com/buildingbrands. And because you're a faithful listener to this show, I want to offer you a bonus. If you buy the book before September 1st, you can send in your receipt and book a free consultation with me. Together, we can review your branding projects, talk about your team's workflow, or discuss productivity more generally. This is only for the remainder of August, so make sure you head over to busycreator.com/buildingbrands and send me the receipt when you buy the book. We'll have a link to all that in the show notes as well. All right, let's get back into my conversation with Kat. Okay, Kat. So let's talk about introverts and extroverts and this whole conversation. How did this get started for you? Was it from reading Susan Cain's book?
Actually, that came later. The first thing was a friend of mine. I think I was explaining how I was happy to be quite, well, I don't think I used the word extrovert, but outgoing in social situations. But that for some reason, I would be done after like a drink and then just want to leg it. And I think that the term is the Irish exit or the Irish goodbye. Oh, yeah. I would want to go. And I couldn't understand it. My friend was like, oh, well, you're an introvert. Obviously. I was like, no, I'm not. I'm not shy.
Yeah.
And they were like, that's not what an introvert is. It's nothing to do with that. It's to do with your energy.
Right.
And I was like, what is this woo-woo stuff? And then it turned out to be far more, I wouldn't call it super scientific, but definitely based on a test that has been used for, you know, decades to match up like a set of personality types, down to 16 types.
You're talking about the Myers-Briggs system, right?
I am talking about Myers-Briggs, okay. Yeah. And I just wrote, because I was looking into this a little bit further the other day, I know that there are a lot of different ways to personality type us. And I don't actually think Myers-Briggs is the most commonly used. I think now it's the Big Five, which roughly corresponds to Myers-Briggs. But anyway,
okay.
The one thing that has been scientifically proven, as it were, is the difference between introverts and extroverts. So where we get our energy from. Mm. And obviously Susan Cain has kind of brought this into the popular forefront.
Yeah, with her book Quiet. I should mention the title of the book. It's Quiet. It's about, I forget the subtitle, How Introverts Can Excel in the World of Yada, Yada, Yada. Yeah.
Yeah. And so then I did pick that book up and I was like, yes, this is me. I can totally relate to everything that she describes what an introvert is and how we are kind of shoehorned into this extrovert world.
Right.
At least in our society. It's true that it's not the case in every society, and I think that's an interesting conversation in itself. But I started to notice that many of my creative friends were also introverts, and I just couldn't help but start drawing all of these connections between our behaviours and preferences and how we worked. And I just couldn't stop myself from learning more about it and seeing how, as introverts, we do naturally struggle with the promotion side of the job.
Yeah.
And this isn't to say that all creatives are introverts. It's definitely not the case. And I've certainly learned that we all have different ways of working. But one common thing is that introverts generally will agree that self-promotion is one of the hardest things naturally. We overanalyze things. We are very introspective. And like I said, even those networking events, I don't know anyone who really enjoys networking events, but there is a difference between doing okay at one and just really wanting to leg it as soon as you've been there half an hour.
Sure, sure. And I think I'm going to go back to Myers-Briggs real quick, that part of the problem, perhaps, is that it gives it a false binary, that the Myers-Briggs results, you either have E or I as the first letter of your short form. And that kind of overlooks how the reality that most people are ambiverts and most people are on this continuum. You're not necessarily one extreme or the other, but rather you're at different times, you have different flavors and different emotions and that sort of thing. Have you found that as well, that there is a gray area? And that it...
I would say that there are two schools of thought there, whether anyone can actually be an ambivert, in the same way that if you're ambidextrous, you can write with both hands, but you still have a slight preference to another. So in my head, and from what I've read, we are one or the other, but it could be literally like 51-49%.
Right, right, right.
You know what I mean? And so I think that's where the misconception is, the fact that people are like, well, because I'm an introvert, that's it, and I can never do extroverted things. And like you said, that's just not the case.
Yeah.
We can all be one or the other, and none of us are 100% one or the other.
Sure, sure.
It is this sliding scale, and different times call for different modalities, I guess. And it shows up. Like yesterday, I spent a very busy day. It was the Brighton Pride, and there was a massive parade through the streets, and it was the most extroverted event I think I've ever seen or witnessed.
Right, right.
And I was with friends, and you know, I spent the whole day, and I was energized that whole time. I was super. That was me extroverting, I guess. But today, yes, I'm wiped out, and that's okay. And I think honoring that and not setting up like another social event for today, that's how I work with my introversion.
Yeah.
It's not like, oh, I just decided not to go to that event yesterday because I'm an introvert. I wouldn't possibly enjoy it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So it's knowing this and knowing where your boundaries are and how best you can make the most of your time.
Yeah, totally. And I think that's also part of the misconception, that people think introverts are freaking autistic, that they can't have conversations and they can't operate in an office environment or in a social environment. I don't know where that came from, but that's troubling. And especially, again, to go back to Myers-Briggs, that a lot of times you'll see in a business setting, in a big corporate environment, that they'll give people that test. I don't know if it's part of the recruiting process, like where you can't get through unless you take the test, but oftentimes just anecdotal once you're in the organization. And I think it's really dangerous, because a lot of times if you have I in your result, they will view you as that you'll never have management potential.
Yes.
And I don't think that's the case. I think that's, you know, again, the kind of false binary, you get painted with that brush, which is really strange. So I'm glad that, you know, folks like you and Susan Cain are out there kind of explaining and expanding on the definitions. And but real quick, before I forget, the test of introvert versus extrovert, supposedly, is whether or not you would ever go to the movies by yourself. So if you're an introvert, you'd be like, oh yeah, no problem. I'll go to the movies by myself. I go every day by myself, or whatever it is. And then occasionally on the opposite, you'll meet someone who cannot wrap their head around it. They're like, why would you ever go? I've never been to the movies by myself. I couldn't even imagine going to the movies by myself. So that's a funny litmus test for that.
Yeah. And it's strange. Like, I would say that you can condition yourself to think that you wouldn't like that. But then when you discover, like, I always thought the idea of eating alone was the saddest thing in the world, like going to a restaurant.
Right.
And, you know, it was all the same thing until I started traveling alone. And I started doing these things, and I was like, actually, this wasn't so bad, and this suits me, and oh yeah, this all fits in with my introversion. But without knowing these things, without giving them a go, and putting yourself into those situations in the same way that if I was to put myself into an extrovert situation like public speaking, yeah, it wouldn't feel comfortable to me maybe at first, In fact, it definitely doesn't. But it's a process. And if we just try these things, regardless of what we've been branded as, I think that's an important thing to do.
Sure. So do you think that being an introvert is necessarily a disadvantage as a creative pro, especially if you're trying to kick butt in a business world, not just be a good operator, a fine craftsman, illustrator, whatever, but to create a project that has global reach and to write a book and to speak and to teach and whatever, all these other things?
I think it has been demonstrated by a lot of these introvert writers and leaders, because people are talking about this more now. People being identified, for example, Bill Gates being a classic and obviously very well-known introvert. Susan Cain, she's obviously been speaking and gone on book tours. And we definitely can't use our introversion as an excuse.
Right.
But when it comes to the advantages, which I definitely think there are many, things like being able to have extreme empathy with somebody, I think that's always going to help in any one-to-one meeting, networking events. And if you were to write a book, then all of those things, spending these like long working days of just working on your craft, that's going to be pretty easy for an introvert to adapt to. But yes, there are definitely struggles. I think the biggest struggle, though, is thinking that social anxiety and other things that can come with introversion is going to stop you from doing these things. So it's really the only thing stopping any creative who does want to get their work out there is limiting self-beliefs. Mm-hmm. It's definitely not the introversion, in my opinion.
Yeah, no, that's a challenge. And I take it then that's part of the origin of your site, The Creative Introvert. Is that part of the origin story, that you wanted to serve a community?
100%. It is that kind of frustration of seeing my fellow creative introverts and seeing the limiting beliefs that they were putting on themselves. And that's why I do talk about mindset, and I can get a bit woo-woo sometimes, because I just think that that's where it all starts. So, you know, you can talk endlessly about social media and building email lists and all of those things that actually introverts are fine with, because it still means that they're protected by their computer screen and they can do all of it from behind the glass. But when it actually comes to removing those limiting beliefs and pushing yourself out of your comfort zone, I felt like that was the message that I really had to hit home with. And yeah, that's the battle. That is what I'm trying to do.
Okay. So what's on the site now, or what is the project delivering on a daily basis?
I've just finished a launch for it was an online course, 4 weeks long, called Get Your Art Out Summer Camp. And that's kind of, I'm just taking a breather now that that's kind of out into the world. And I've been doing a lot of research. I'm sort of in research mode. I go into different modes. Mm. And a lot of what I'm doing right now is looking at how to make the most of all the different 16 personality types. I will start with introverts, the 8 personality types of that, and how that fits into a creative workflow. And when it comes to self-promo, but everything from creating the work to collaborating with others, all of these elements, how we do it all differently depending on what our personality type is. And it's basically all in the progress of research, and there has been a lot of work done. David B. Goldstein and Otto Kroger, recently deceased, they've put out an amazing book called Creative You. Mm. And I've been digging into that and like going a bit further and really trying to pull stuff out and see how I can help my audience with that.
Okay. And I'm interested too to hear your anecdotal research, your experience, your non-academic research, about the association, perhaps, on different learning styles. Because I know that that's maybe a different axis. So you have introvert, extrovert on one axis. On the other one is the learning styles that I've hearing more about this recently, about how some people like to read and just get the info and just zap it into their brain, especially in the printed or screen form. Other people like audio and video, and they could listen to podcasts or watch a series of whatever YouTube channels. And then other people like the in-person. They like the lecture and conference format and that type of thing. Do you find an association between introverts, extroverts, and a sort of learning style?
That's so interesting. I haven't looked into that, but I've always been obsessed with learning styles. I remember being taught about that in school and being like, am I a visual? Surely I'm a visual. I'm a creative.
Yeah.
But actually, especially in more recent years, adapting a lot more to audio, because I listen to so many podcasts and audiobooks, realizing that actually this is how I've started to prefer to learn.
Yeah.
And then video again, it kind of combines the two. So maybe that's best. I wouldn't say that anyone should just think that there's like one learning style that's best suited for anyone. I think they're all worth exploring. I haven't really looked into how introversion and extroversion affects that. But I do think that sensing types and intuitive types, so that's the next letter on from introvert, extrovert on the Myers-Briggs type indicator.
Yep.
I would have assumed that sensors would be more the hands-on learners. They learn by doing. Whereas intuitives would be more conceptual in how they learn and could probably read and listen to things. That might be more preferred. So that's just something that I would love to study a bit more, and I wouldn't want to make any assumptions, but I'm sure that there are links to all of this stuff.
Sure. And this is something too that I've struggled with as the creator of the Busy Creator, that doing a site and a podcast. Okay, so you have like a blog article, for example, and some people are going to gobble that up and you're going to read every paragraph and it's totally going to make sense to them. Other people are going to prefer a podcast episode or discussion, whatever. Other people are still, they're looking for an infographic or they're looking for an in-person event to cover the same topics that I did three, whatever, blog posts on, you know, that type of thing.
Yeah.
So you're kind of like, okay, what's natural for me to produce, but then what's natural for my audience to consume? And is there a disconnect there? Is there a kind of hill to get over where, for example, if you're a natural writer and you can just let words flow like crazy, and someone says, hey man, where's your infographics at? And you're like, oh, well, now I got to find someone else to do it and then distill in, you know, that type of thing. So it becomes a challenge as a content producer, as the manager of a community.
Yeah, I like seeing it as an experiment. And I'm definitely, like, I think my best way of expressing myself is through the written word.
Uh-huh.
But then because I don't read blog posts as much as I used to, and I'm wondering if that's just a general trend that people are reading less, but listening more and watching more.
Mm.
And at least in the last year and a half, that's what I've been seeing myself. So I've kind of had to push myself outside of my comfort zone of writing and think, how can I repurpose this that might serve my audience better? If it works for me, then I should be doing what I've seen work.
Yeah.
And see how my audience responds.
Absolutely.
But then, like I said, I'm not great at just talking to a camera, especially when it comes to monologuing. This is part of being an introvert. I have things going on in my head, but expressing them is not easy. So I need that time to write things down. But what I have found is that by dictating what I've written, and then I can repurpose that same blog post as a video. And because I like making graphics, I can make it quite graphical and I don't have to actually be on camera.
Right.
And so it's still using all of my skills, but delivering it in a way that maybe my audience might like better.
Sure.
It's an experiment.
Absolutely. And when I spoke to Grammar Girl last year, we talked about this and the concept of applesaucing, where you have the tree which bears the fruit, but then the apples that don't get sold get turned into applesauce and into apple butter and into apple flavored Fig Newtons. And you kind of reuse the content.
Yes.
Once you've gone through the effort to plant the tree and to grow it, and et cetera. But yeah, totally a challenge. And you'll see a lot of articles. Now, Pat Flynn just wrote one about repurposing your content. Actually, he wrote two. One was repurposing blog content or written content. And then another one was about repurposing podcast episodes. And it's the same type of thing. It's kind of like, hey, once you create something, you can translate it into a bunch of different things. And that's great, except it takes a lot of energy, especially in my opinion, to go from something that is inherently verbal, like written, and then to start creating like a slideshow and custom infographic. Like, that's a huge amount of work. And the same thing is the opposite. If you're having a natural conversation, now you got to get someone to transcribe it and summarize it. And then, you know, so it's not the instantaneous sharing version. Like, I feel like sometimes, and again, this comes down to the promotion and the anxiety about always being out there in the world, that a lot of folks who are photographers and illustrators or even like whatever, bikini models, you know, they go on Instagram. It's like a natural translation. It's like, boom, they could take their work, their day job, and they could just put it up somewhere and it's automatically kind of seen and understood. Whereas if you're writing about, let's say, studio workflow for the creative professions, like, how do you translate that into an 800 by 800 square? It takes a little bit more synthesis, you know what I'm saying?
So without forcing it,
yeah.
You don't want it to be super forced.
Yeah, exactly.
But I'd also say that it could be like a balancing act. So at the same time, repurposing content can be great if that means you're saving time on thinking up a whole new subject. And that's, I guess, the angle that people like Pat are coming at.
Yeah.
That you're actually saving time. But it's a balance. Like you said, if you're spending even more time doing the repurposing and it's actually not worth it,
yeah,
then what's the point? But yeah, it's a balancing act.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm reminded too about upcycling and downcycling, right? And this is the term in recycling, that if you take something that's made out of plastic or whatever, you might think, okay, your plastic Coca-Cola bottle gets recycled and it turns into another Coca-Cola bottle. But chances are it gets downcycled and it gets turned into like the nylon mesh that's on the bottom of a carpet or something like that. So yeah. That's a really weird analogy. But imagine if you did this podcast episode, you had a really great like flowing conversation and blah, blah, blah. And then actually in the end, it just gets translated into a kind of quotation as image, like those motivational images that end up on Pinterest or whatever. And yeah, those are popular. But think about it. You just had a 45-minute conversation with someone and it got boiled down to 8 words. And you know, and then you put that into an image. So it's almost downcycled rather than translated.
Yeah, I feel like it's a really great opportunity, though, in this era that we actually have to be able to do all of these different things and do it basically all ourselves.
Right.
Yes, we can like speed things up by outsourcing stuff. But as creators, we have this power to put out so many different forms of content. Whereas, you know, you can just imagine all of the writers or painters or whatever, they were just doing their one thing. They couldn't just take it and turn it into something else.
Yeah.
And I wonder if that's like a bit of a stress for us, which I guess it can be. But I also see it as a great opportunity. And I really am grateful that we can do that.
Yeah.
It's good fun. I've learned all these skills, like putting together this online course, learning about video and trying to put that all together. It was just like another string I felt like I got to add to my bow. Whereas some would say that, oh no, I could have just outsourced that.
Yeah, that's a whole other conversation too. But
yeah,
let's not go down that rabbit hole about online courses and whether or not you outsource things. But I'm curious to hear about the community aspect of the creative introvert. And I saw on your site that you have a paid for community that brings people together, and it is like a membership system, which is something that's, I think, really cool. But I'm curious, that how did you launch a community when especially there's a marketing and an outreach challenge for introverts? Did you find it to be a challenge specifically because you're asking people who don't normally kind of reach out and join communities to do just that?
This is something that I've kind of half written a blog post about, this, like, why would an introvert start a community? And it definitely has been a bit of a challenge to get people who might be members of, say, Facebook groups, but wouldn't be actively engaging. They might be reading the content and really enjoying it, but weren't necessarily the first ones to comment and do all the things. But I found that with some coaxing, and I've been learning from this, like, how can I make the posts that I'm putting out there or the emails that I'm writing and all of the help that I'm trying to give suit my members, but also try to push them a little bit as well, because I think we all need a push. So one of the things that I put out to the community about 2 months ago was, would you like a mastermind? Mm-hmm. Or would you like some like one-to-one accountability partnering? And I thought, surely everyone would want a mastermind because they're so powerful. And, you know, we're reading all these blog posts about how having a mastermind is so great.
Yeah.
But naturally, as introverts generally prefer one-to-one. And definitely when I asked them to vote on what they preferred, some said a mastermind would be great, but overwhelmingly it was all about the accountability partners. So I set that up, and it was really great to have that feedback. And I was like, thank God I didn't just say, you must have a mastermind group. It must be 5 people. And, you know, I think it's definitely at the moment, because it's been running since January, February, and it's still very much led by the community. Everyone who's in there right now, they're making this happen. They are creating it with me. And I'm just trying to respond to what they need.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. And I think, of course, the common wisdom, right, is like, why not both? Like, have your accountability partner for a day-to-day and week-to-week, but then your mastermind group is the folks you see 3 or 4 times a year, and you have a really deep dive. And then the third part of that kind of three-legged stool is the mentor or the advisor person, which, I mean, I've talked about this on the show, too, that all three of those can be difficult to come by, and it's always better when it's in person too, which can be, I guess, depending on where you live, it can be extra difficult to come by.
Yes. And again, that was something that I knew wouldn't be easy. And in fact, the majority of my members are in the States and I'm not. Okay. So I like, thank God for Skype, because I do think that's been a great way of conducting all of this. And that has been what I've been doing. But I know for a fact that the power of being in person is huge. And what I would like to do is some kind of events that might happen, you know, once a year, whether it's in the UK, I can come to the States. More than happy to do that.
Yeah.
But I've also been using Meetup in my own local area and in London to try and get people together. And there are meetups with introverts, and it's interesting. It definitely is a quieter group, but then everyone warms up and you have these really deep conversations because we're skipping the small talk and just getting into these big topics. And I really love that. And I definitely think there's a place for these real life meetings.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. And I started a meetup group as well, the New York City Podcast Meetup, which I've been doing since February. And again, it's the same thing. It's like, I didn't really want to be the host, but no one else was doing it. So I had to kind of jump on that grenade myself.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's another kind of analogy that's common to the introvert-extrovert conversation is that the introverts would prefer a dinner party with friends, whereas the extroverts will want to like hit the disco and go to, you know, meet hundreds of people in one night. And it's the same thing. You're being social, but it's just a different mechanism or a different enaction of that.
Completely. And it's making sure that environment, wherever it is, whether it's in a Facebook group, via email, on Skype, in person, that it all kind of, it does feel right for us. And because I'm an introvert, I think we all get it. Like the whole group gets it.
Yeah. Awesome. And is it a Facebook group? You didn't mention specifically.
Yeah, sorry. So that's part of it. It's a mixture of things.
Okay.
And I'm kind of keep adding to it, I guess, as I go. And I think, like, what else would people need? So it's the Facebook group. I also do a lot of reviews with people if they need feedback on their website or copy, stuff like that. We've been doing skill sharing. It's anything that I think would be helpful. Oh, and we've got a monthly, well, every 6 weeks now, book club.
Oh, interesting.
And that's been really great. The last book that's going to be coming up is The Awakened Introvert. Yeah, it's been a fantastic read. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll get that on the list as well.
Yeah.
I'm always curious about the community side of things, though, because a lot of podcasters and a lot of bloggers and just people in general, like everyone's into creating communities now. And with the internet, you can be a part of different communities concurrently. But at the same time, they're hard to just pop into existence. And if you said, hey, we've got this thing, it's for, you know, dog lovers in East Brooklyn, or I don't know.
Yeah.
Like just because you make it doesn't mean it's going to be this hopping thing. There's a lot of kind of alchemy, this soup again of psychology and opportunity and promotion versus if you have one or two members, and it goes back to Malcolm Gladwell's thing, like you need the connectors and then you need the other people that are all part of it.
Completely. And I'm very interested in how communities change after certain numbers of people. Have you heard about the 3 and 10 rule? It's quite interesting, but it's how, say, small companies change after, you know, there's one person, then it changes dramatically when there are 3, and then when there are 10, 30, 100, and so on.
Okay.
So I've kind of been interested in seeing how that works within Facebook groups. So I'm a member of like a lot of Facebook groups, but quite specific about the ones that I pop up regularly in, and they definitely all have like a similar number in common, and it's usually a much smaller number.
Right.
When it does get to a very big number and everyone is being super loud, it's like, what's the point? I might as well be on Twitter.
Right.
So I like the idea that because this is quite a closed, and obviously it's a paid membership site, and that gives it a bit more of a limit. You know, I don't expect this to grow massively and become this massive thing. I don't think that would be helpful for anyone.
Yeah, I've heard similar things about communities or about groups like that, that if it's literally one or two people, you could probably just email back and forth, even though that's little cumbersome. But then as soon as you get 5, 6, 7, okay, now you need something else. Maybe a Slack team is better because you're not writing huge, like topic disparate things. You're just kind of zapping information. And then once you get to a certain point of 20 or something, okay, maybe it's time for a Facebook group. And then once you get to thousands or hundreds, then you might have to go to a custom forum because, in my opinion, and again, we've talked about it on the show, I don't want to go down the rabbit hole, but like, I just hate Facebook groups. And because this is the problem, is that everything is in one place. So there's nowhere to go just for your interest. But that's just the mechanism of it. But I think what we were saying about the community itself is more important, because hopefully we can solve the mechanism, the technology element of it.
Yeah. And like I said, I think there definitely has to be some foresight from the group host, as it were. You know, just like if you're holding a party in your house, like you need to take responsibility for that and respond to the group as it goes.
Yeah.
But that could be the same on any platform. It's definitely a job, and that is a comfort zone thing as an introvert. Like, how do you manage people? I'm not a manager.
Right.
going back to our original conversation, it's being a kind of artisan, like I can come in and go, but the idea of like leading this massive team is scary, to say the least. Yeah.
Okay, well, a lot of insight there about communities, and we could totally examine that all day, but we are sort of wrapping up. So I want to ask about your personal routines. Do you have a wake up time, an exercise habit, a coffee habit, something that keeps you productive and creative?
Yeah, I'm like a robot, a creative robot. I'm really into my routine, and I do shake it up from time to time, but it starts early, like 4:30 or 5.
Wow.
Most days, and I go straight into yoga, do a bit of quite gentle stretching, hydrate, then I do a bit of journaling, meditation, coffee. Then it just like, okay, let's really like kick it in. I have been recently going through a habit of doing the hardest thing during my morning coffee, because the coffee is something that I can look forward to, but doing the hard thing. And that's generally sending out an email, because I just find that really hard, like reaching out to you. Everything is just, okay, I'm reaching out to a stranger. Am I bothering them? Where can this go? How can I do this without just being a stranger on the internet?
Yeah.
And I found that if I don't do that first thing, it's not going to happen. And then my day can pretty much begin. I'll do whatever I have to do, but it's getting the order right. And that's always something that I encourage people to play around with. Like having a routine doesn't mean that's your routine for life.
Yeah, exactly. That's something we've talked about on the show too. Experiment, use yourself as a guinea pig, test and iterate.
Yeah.
And again, if you want to replace the word routine with rhythm, now it sounds productive rather than restrictive, right? So a routine is like what, you know, if you're at boarding school or something and there's like Swiss French nuns beating you, I don't know. It kind of has these connotations, but if you say, oh, I'm in a rhythm, you know, here's my productive routine, my productive groove, that's a little bit of a different story.
Yeah.
But yeah, interesting to hear. Did you follow Hal Elrod's methodology in the Miracle Morning?
No, but I've heard him on so many podcasts. I was like, okay, I get it. And I love what you're doing. So
yeah.
No, but it's been taken from like a mixture of things. I think I've tried so many different orders.
Yeah. Okay. And then what's something you're struggling with or you're currently sort of looking to overcome?
I would say everything that I try to overcome, it usually boils down to a fear. So at the moment, it's definitely this fear of public speaking, of going live on camera, and all of these kind of putting the same thoughts that I'm putting out there into my blog, translating that into different mediums. And usually that involves talking to a lot of people. And it's just a totally unwarranted fear.
Interesting. Okay. Well, I guess the best way to get over that is to do it in small increments, right? That try a 6-second video or a 20-second video and that sort of thing. And but yeah, like I tell everyone who starts a podcast or is thinking about it, I'm like, you have to get through those first few. Like they're going to be weird. They're going to be awkward, especially if you edit yourself. You're going to hate your own voice, and you get better fast. And by the time you get to episode 10 or 11, you're like a pro at this. You're like, man, those early ones were rough.
And I think I just heard a quote today. This is from Seneca. Like, so that's pretty old. But the idea that once you've started something, you're more than halfway there. Like,
oh yeah,
it's
interesting.
Just starting is just everything. And I'm a big proponent of just ship, you know, just get something out there.
Absolutely. Ready, fire, aim.
Yeah.
Okay, so how can we see more of your work, read about The Creative Introvert, sign up, join the community, etc., get in touch in general?
Well, my online home is thecreativeintrovert.com, and everything is there. I won't bombard you with more links, but you'll find it all there.
Okay, great. Well, Kat, thanks a lot for your time. It's really interesting, and I hope we can see you soon at some conference or meetup.
Yeah, hopefully I will. Thank you so much, Prescott.
All right, take care.
Bye.
Okay, that was Kat. Yeah, good chat just there. I think Kat is very much a fellow traveler with many of us out there, not only being a solo designer, but also building a side project and struggling with promotion and awareness and constantly improving and testing her new habits, her new experiences, new ideas. And that's always the most important thing. So if you take away any one thing from this conversation, just be aware of yourself and push yourself, even if you're an introvert. As I mentioned, I've got links to everything we discussed over at busycreator.com/90. Once again, busycreator.com/90. And that's where you can leave us a comment, get in touch with Kat, check out her online course, and join the community for introverts. That same show notes page will help you learn about everything that the Busy Creator has to offer. And by the way, if you're on a mobile device, you should be able to click the album art in your player to get the show notes, and then you can click directly on the links. You also heard a fleeting mention of the New York City podcast meetup. So if you're in the New York City metro area, definitely join us for a future event. We have one on August 23rd, but it may be a bit too late depending on when you're listening. But there will be more. So visit the website nycpodmeet.com for details and to RSVP to future events. Next time on the podcast, I speak to Nick Spriggs, a graphic and web designer and partner at a small firm.
What really interests me was being able to have design and development and digital marketing in-house and really be working, you know, as a full-service team. The developers can be part of our design process, and the designers can really be part of the development process.
And that episode will be released in 2 weeks. Make sure you subscribe in iTunes or Google Play Music or on your phone's podcast app so you don't miss future episodes. You've been listening to the Busy Creator Podcast, a production of Starship Design, offering strategy and design to intelligent brands. Our website is starship.design. The Busy Creator's theme song was composed by Joaquin Kotler. Check him out at joaquinkotler.com. Thanks to Dave Farrell for editing help this week. His website is podio.co. That's podio.co. I'm Prescott Perez Fox, and thank you for listening to the Busy Creator Podcast. I'm hanging out online, so come connect with me. And until next time, get busy and create.